As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Show. Derek Van Riper here with Al Melchior. It is Friday, June 17th. We're talking waiver wire as we do each and every week. Obviously, no live version of this show today. We're recording a little bit early. And if I've learned anything in the last 3 years or so, Al, it's that I have to be a more flexible person. In this case, there is construction happening on my building. And as I've learned, when you record podcasts at home, and people are going to replace your windows for you, you really can't do much about that. You just have to be happy to have new windows and record your podcast a little bit earlier and change your plans accordingly. So episode a little different this week, but structurally the same. So I think people will be happy regardless. Let's get into it with some bats to consider right off the top. And Jonathan India came off the IL earlier this week. He's 86% rostered in CBS, so I'm not putting him at the top of the rundown because he's widely available, but I'm putting him there because I think he should be 100% rostered. I think what we saw from Jonathan India a season ago, you know, working his way into the primary leadoff role for the Reds, basically becoming a five-category player, I think a lot of that was real. And as long as he doesn't have another setback with his hamstring and end up back on the IL, I think there's a very good chance that from today forward, he's the type of player that should be rostered and active in basically all formats because of his contributions.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, I understand that. You know, we talk about it a lot, right, with bench spots and IL spots or leagues that maybe don't have either. And so that, I'm sure, explains the roster rate that's lower than it probably should be. And he was out for a long time. But now's the time to get him if you dropped him or if somebody else did in your shallower leagues.
Yeah, we just have a good sense that this time maybe he's actually going to be healthy because they gave him a longer stint on the IL. So I think that's part of where my optimism comes from. And I think it's a Reds lineup that now they're getting everybody back. Those counting stats might begin to look more like we would expect them to for a team that plays in really the most hitter-friendly ballpark in the league outside of Colorado, the most homer-friendly ballpark in the league too. So a lot to like here as the Reds try and put the pieces back together, playing more like 500 ball after that dismal start too. So things are heading in the right direction. Gabriel Moreno, a frequent topic of conversation on this show for the last week or so, still out there in some leagues and impressive in what he's done so far. Playing time share looks like he's going to play probably about two-thirds of the time for now. I think there's a path for him to play more if he continues to hit. So if you didn't get him last week and you're in a single catcher league especially, there's a chance he might be out there and he might be a better option if you've been streaming the position or really just chasing production all season long.
Yeah, I mean, compared to a week ago when we had this discussion, I'm definitely a little bit more encouraged about Moreno. I'm definitely a little bit more willing to take that leap in the one catcher leagues, which is at this point probably the only place where you're going to be able to add Moreno. But we're looking at obviously a pretty small sample, even from AAA, not a great sample, but in the major league level, just a few games still. But what we can see in that small sample, and if you go, you know, to a little bit more granular level of indicator, like whiff rate and things like that, chase rate. Well, the chase rate's actually abysmal, but the whiff rate's really low. It's right around 6%. He hasn't barreled yet, but again, he's only put 14 balls in play. So, you know, all it would take is one barrel to give him a normal barrel rate, basically, to make him look like a great power hitter. So that it's a little too early to judge there. But based at least on the contact skills, it looks like maybe the worst case scenario here for Moreno is like a K-Bear Ruiz profile.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I'll take that in a one catcher league. Absolutely.
Yeah. Especially when it comes with a lineup that is looking a bit more like the lineup we saw a season ago, too. The supporting cast for the Jays putting the pieces together in recent weeks as well. Let's get to Jake Berger. I think he's pretty interesting because he has stepped up for the White Sox. They've had plenty of injuries, kind of picking away key members of their starting lineup over the course of the season. Berger's got 8 homers now in 38 games. He is day-to-day with a hand injury after getting hit by a pitch a couple of days back. So keep an eye on him through the weekend. Just make sure this doesn't turn into an IL stint. But even though it's a little more of a free-swinging approach, I mean, we talk about chase rate, as Eno calls it, or O-swing percentage, as just about everybody else calls it. Even though that number sits right around 40% right now, I think I'm willing to accept it because Jake Berger is barreling the ball a lot, and that was something he did in very limited chances with the White Sox a season ago. And if you look at these last two seasons combined, he's played 53 games in the big leagues, and it's not even 200 plate appearances yet, but a 15.7% barrel rate, that's barrels per batted ball event, that is really impressive. And I think that's high enough for me to justify the swing and miss that is likely to be a pretty consistent part of his profile.
Yeah. And normally a chase rate like that is a little bit of a cause for concern. I just brought it up for Moreno as something to be wary of. But you look at the leaderboard, or I should say maybe the laggard board for hitter chase rate, the highest ones. And not surprisingly, you see Rafael Devers up in the top 10, Salvador Perez, Ryan Mountcastle. So I'm not going to disqualify any of these hitters because they're super aggressive and maybe don't have the most patience. So in the case of Jake Berger, yeah, you're getting something. You're getting substantial upside to go with that downside. And he's backing up that barrel rate with a high exit velocity on flies and liners. So for all the things that I would want to have Jake Berger on my team for, all the indicators look really great.
Yeah. And I guess it's reach rate that Eno calls it. Chase rate is what a lot of people call it. O-swing percentage is what it's called on Fangraphs. So happy to clear that up. But I do think third base has also been one of those positions where there's been a surprising number of disappointing depth players so far this season. So there's been a little more turnover in those spots, especially in deeper mixed leagues, than I expected coming into the year. I was a believer in Mike Moustakas, for example. I didn't think Jamer Candelario was going to be unproductive or at least drop off the way that he has. So there's been a few guys like that that have really opened the door for players like Berger to become more fantasy relevant along the way. The other player that I think is really interesting, if you're looking for some power that could be impactful in even a more shallow mixed league, is Alex Kirilloff. I think he came up on our prospect pod a couple of weeks ago when we were doing our last review of AAA. He's still mashing at St. Paul right now, and I think it's just a question of when the Twins are going to fit him back into their plans. In what types of leagues are you ready to stash Kirilloff now? He's already 45% rostered in CBS leagues, which is higher than I expected for a guy that's been down as long as he's been down.
Yeah, and just based on my own anecdotal experience, that's much higher than I thought because I'm pretty sure he's still available in one of my 15-teamers. So I should definitely be checking on that. The window is closing in anything that's deep like that. He's certainly a must-roster hitter there. 12-teamers is a little tougher, I think, because maybe he is off the radar in a lot of those leagues that maybe you can wait another week or two to pick up Kirilloff there. And I admit I have a little bit of skepticism because it is one thing to put up the kinds of numbers he's putting up at AAA and another thing to do the same kind of thing against major league pitching. So it's obviously better than him not hitting well at AAA, but I'm not quite there yet in 12-teamers for him.
I think even when I go back to his debut last season with the Twins, a 22.5% K rate for a guy that hits the ball as hard as he does is not bad. And that was in a sample that was a little larger than what Jake Berger's had as more of an up and down backup sort of player for the White Sox up to this point. So I think if I'm choosing between the two, the long-term profile I believe in more is Kirilloff, but I think they're actually kind of similar in terms of their short-term expectations. I'm not expecting Kirilloff to come back and hold a similar K rate to what he has at AAA right now, but it gives me a lot of long-term optimism that what we saw a season ago might be more real than not on that front at the higher level. So just a question of making the pieces fit, I suppose, in Minnesota right now. But that's another lineup, though. When someone gets inserted into that lineup, you're getting above average run production because of the way they've put runs on the board this year. So I think that's the added lift that you can get from Kirilloff that you might not get from other players available on the wire. Michael Harris still out there in some more shallow leagues. And I guess I want to ask, can you make a case for him in even a 10-team league as long as you're starting five outfielders, considering the playing time volume? He has started 18 consecutive games entering play on Friday, all of them coming from the number nine spot, but this is another lineup that's really heated up in recent weeks, and hitting ninth for Atlanta might be like hitting sixth on a below average team.
That's a really good point, because I have been discounting Harris a little bit because of where he hits in the Braves order, but yeah, he's in a great lineup. He's certainly doing his part, hitting with power, striking out at a reasonable rate, hitting for a .328 batting average, which probably isn't sustainable with the .400 BABIP, but he's, you know, with the speed that he has, could be a better than average BABIP guy. So basically just a long way of saying that Harris is profiling, despite where he hits in the order, profiling as somebody who maybe could be an all-category contributor. I'll be honest and say I hadn't really considered him for 10 teamers at this point. That I think that's where him batting lower in the order maybe makes him lose a tiebreaker to maybe be the most generous about it, but he absolutely belongs in 12 teamers, and you're not going to get him anywhere deeper most likely at this point.
Yeah, I think the 12 is probably the more appropriate cutoff, but I think you could do worse if you had injury issues in a 10-team league and you're trying to choose between Harris and a lot of similarly skilled players or other guys that have some questions. The questions here do come from a young player just seeing big league pitching for the first time. A 41.3% O-swing percentage to this point is a bit of a concern. You know, seeing the walk rate cut in half compared to where it was at AA, not a surprise at all for a 21-year-old making the leap like this. He is more than holding his own so far, but I do think it's gone better than I expected, even though I like him a lot long-term as a prospect. But Michael Harris getting a lot of playing time in this really good Atlanta lineup. Some deeper league bats to consider. It seemed like last week was the week of the catcher injury. A lot of catchers hit the IL. We got Carson Kelly back, which, you know, before he was hurt, he was a drag for anybody who had him in the lineup. I mean, I have him in NL labor. I think it's the only league where I have him. That's a 12-team NL-only league with two catchers. And he was definitely hurting me in that format. And it's really hard to be a below-average player in a 12-team NL-only league. So I liked Kelly enough for that format going into the season. Obviously, in that league, I waited it out, and I'm going to use him again. This was not anywhere close to what people expected from him. I think there's going to be a good bit of playing time for him because they're going to move Dalton Varsho mostly back into the outfield. And yeah, Varsho's going to play a lot, but I think Kelly can still play a lot too. Is it possible to get something that more closely resembles even his 2021 numbers again if 2019's out of reach? Can we see 240 and a dozen home runs kind of as a baseline skill output from Carson Kelly?
I don't see why not. It's obviously hard for us to tell from afar, but I think given the lack of depth at catcher that he becomes somebody who automatically should be starting as the second catcher in a mixed league. And as you said, definitely is must roster in mono leagues. Not that I think that he's out there in mono leagues, but I'm nowhere close to thinking that Kelly is back to being a one catcher league catcher, but probably out there in some two catcher leagues. It definitely needs to be added there.
Yeah, I keep staring down those 2019 stats, which we know with the year of the rabbit ball, dangerous to expect anyone to give us the same power they were offering in 2019. He had 18 home runs that year and just 365 plate appearances. I thought part of the appeal with Carson Kelly coming into the season was that he could be a 450 to 500 plate appearance catcher. Obviously, with the time that he's missed, he's not going to hit that for a season total. But the week-to-week playing time volume could still end up back at the level that it needed to be for him to get there. So that's where I think you might get a slight edge on Carson Kelly compared to some of the other catchers that are in the pool and either on your roster or also in the waiver wire mix right now that you might be thinking about. One of the guys that was picked up in a lot of deeper leagues last weekend, Christian Bethencourt, who's just been so much better than I expected. I think the time back in late April, early May, when it really kind of set in that they were giving him regular opportunities in Oakland to be the DH and first base option for them, I think as soon as I called it out, he started hitting, and I've looked like a doofus ever since. So I will take my L, at least for the last 6 weeks, on Christian Bethencourt. How real is it? Is he a guy that should be consistently rostered now in at least two catcher leagues, given where he hits in that Oakland lineup?
Yeah, between where he hits, how much Bethencourt is playing, and the fact that he is backing up the surface stats that he's put up the last few weeks with a ton of barrels, in that sense, it's real. How sustainable it is, I definitely have some doubts about, because he does have something of a track record previously where he didn't produce like this. But then again, Bethencourt at one point was a top prospect. We do see that sometimes where top prospects bloom really late at the major league level. So I'm not completely dismissing it. It's funny, I picked him up in, it's a league I've referenced several times on this show, a 24-team dynasty league. So where a catcher with a pulse is definitely somebody that you want to add if that player is available. Bethencourt was available. And at the point I added him, which was, I think, just over a week ago, I think he had a single-digit roster rate on CBS. And it's now up in the 20s. In fact, I can tell you exactly. Up to 22% roster rate. So, yeah, people are definitely catching on in the deeper leagues.
Yeah, I know as a replacement for Yasmani Grandal, he was a frequent favorite of a few friends of ours in the industry. And in the more like 15-team mixed leagues, NFBC leagues, he's been scooped up. But that barrel rate is much higher than I expected. And the underlying numbers, bringing it back to Jake Berger, look a lot like Jake Berger. Similar flaws, not a very high walk rate right now. A lot of swings outside the strike zone. But the question with any player in Oakland, and I think this is what makes someone like Bethencourt so appealing, is he going to play at a low enough level to actually lose his job, right? They're not contending. They're going nowhere. So if he's just doing a good job, you know, doing some damage in the middle of the order, if they like him as a good clubhouse guy and just want to keep him around, then he could end up with more playing time than a player with the same skill set would get somewhere else, especially on a contending team where they might be inclined to mix and match a little bit more. But yeah, 15.8% barrel rate is an eye-popping number. So I'm starting to understand why Oakland has decided to give him playing time. I didn't see this coming. Kudos to them for seeing it. That's why they're there, and probably that's why I'm here. Brian Servin in Colorado, just another name if you want to look for someone who's picking up some playing time for the Rockies, probably more for NL-only leagues, but I just thought he was worth a mention. And then I've seen a lot of love for Jose Trevino and Cal Raleigh. I think Cal Raleigh is actually kind of interesting because the overall numbers so far this season, Al, when you glance at them, they're not that impressive. But if you zoom in and look at the last 3 to 4 weeks, he's looking more like a player who's going to be a consistent long-term contributor for us in two-catcher mixed leagues.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with the strikeouts and the batting average for Raleigh. So, you know, once you start to see improvement there, he becomes really intriguing. And I know he's somebody that's gaining some traction as a one-catcher league candidate. I think he's on the fringe of that. I'm not rostering him there yet, but I don't blame others who do. And especially depending on what your categorical needs are. If you need home runs and RBIs, then, you know, he may be the best possible ad out there at the catcher position.
I'm looking at the last month, roughly, of the last 4 weeks. He's got a 217 average, 276 OBP. So that kind of might steer some people away. 478 slugging percentage. So he's popped 5 homers in those last 76 plate appearances, 14 runs driven in, 9 runs scored, 30.3% for the K rate. Much more manageable. I mean, I think when you look at the pool of catchers, especially, it doesn't stand out quite as much as it would against the broader population of bats.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Some other deep league bats to consider. We're talking about Jonathan India off the top as a very shallow league consideration where available. What are you doing with Nick Senzel? I bring him up like every 3 weeks and ask someone a question about Nick Senzel because I clearly have a problem. He low-key might be the new Victor Robles for me, the player that I still believe in, even though no one else really seems to. But I think part of the reason I'm interested is that in 2019, we saw a little bit of everything. We didn't get a great batting average that year. 256 is fine. Certainly doesn't hurt you. But he has lowered his strikeout rate in the parts of the three seasons he's played since then. And I think with the flashes of speed, the athleticism he shows in center field makes me think that the lack of success as a base stealer is not about actually being fast enough to steal bases. It's more about picking his spots more carefully, getting better reads, better jumps, whatever it might be. All of that kind of mushed together, plus the ballpark, all makes me think that we could still see a very useful Nick Senzel, like the kind of useful that in a 12-team mixed league where you start five outfielders, you might at some point by the end of the season be happy to have him on your roster. Have I completely lost the plot? Is that going way too far with what Nick Senzel could actually do now that he seems to finally be healthy again?
I think you make a compelling case, and I mean, the key thing here is that Senzel is still really widely available. So, I mean, if we were talking about 12-teamers, yeah, I would think that that was probably a bridge too far. But everything that you say about the various things that we've seen in Senzel's profile, yeah, I mean, there still is the possibility that he can consolidate those skills and break out. And I'm looking up the home road splits because last time I looked, the Reds were the best offensive team in their home venue. And in fact, not necessarily the way that you would expect, but Senzel is much, much better or has been much, much better at home than on the road so far this year, hitting .270 with just one homer, a couple of doubles. So, you know, maybe there's more coming there. Maybe there's going to be a little bit more power. And plus, he's in an environment where he's got a better opportunity to produce runs as a part of that lineup. So, yeah, somebody who, for example, on CBS is rostered in just over 10% of leagues. In a deep league, there's definitely some appeal there.
Yeah, maybe the 12-team ceiling is pushing it a little too hard. But here's where I'm going to try and support this ridiculous claim with some evidence that might please the court. If you look at the BatX rest of season projection for Nick Senzel, he's projected to hit .266 with a .321 OBP and a .407 slugging percentage. First number probably more interesting than the last two. That's a 99 WRC plus, so league average production. I mentioned before, good defender in center field, very good defender in center field. They have every incentive with what they've already invested in him to keep playing him. There's not going to be a trade or anything like that. That would be stunning to me if that happened. You look over at the other stats. The projection from the BatX, 7 home runs over the next 75 games, 8 steals, 40 runs, 33 RBIs. So I just doubling that up, right? 75 games. Okay, so that's 14 homers and 16 steals over 150 game pace. And that's the kind of player we'd actually be pretty excited about just because of the speed alone and the difficulty of getting help in that category. So I think the average possibly coming out a little higher than expected, like if that average projection is right and that stolen base projection is right, I think the rest falls into place. And I think the questions we might have about long-term power for Nick Senzel are totally legit, but I do think his home ballpark just kind of gives him some cheapies. Like even if he's the kind of guy that in a neutral park would hit 5 home runs with 500 plate appearances, he might get 8 just because he's in Cincinnati. He might even get 10 because he's in Cincinnati, because that's how much that park can influence that category.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting angle to take with Senzel. One I frankly hadn't taken, and not only does the BatX give him those projections, but it's only slightly more optimistic than what Steamer and Zips have for him rest of season. So I'm thinking, you know, these projection systems are all kind of seeing the same thing, and they're seeing things I'm not seeing. And I could see two areas where I maybe not giving Senzel his due. One is that all these projection systems are seeing more power for Senzel going forward. He's not pulling the ball very much. So if that normalizes and he comes closer to a normal pull rate, you're going to see more home runs. And he's got a 257 BABIP because of a low line drive rate. And that's very variable. So I think, you know, when that normalizes, and it's not a question for me of if, but I think when that normalizes, then you're going to see the batting average come up. So suddenly, through that lens, these projections look pretty reasonable.
All right. I've made my case. I feel like I did a good job, at least in this instance. So we can move on to another player. Tucapita Marcano getting an opportunity in Pittsburgh. He's come up on a few episodes as well. My only real question about him is how much in-game power is there right now? He's not a large player, and he's still very young. He'll turn 23 in September. So I wonder if it's a lot of hit tool and just not enough pop. And then if that's the case, if he's going to steal enough bases, talking about another guy that's had some reasonably pronounced issues with success rates, right? He was 15 for 31 as a base stealer back in 2019. That was at A-ball. Got a pretty aggressive promotion coming off of the lost pandemic season. It was 4 for 8 at AAA with the Padres before getting traded to the Pirates organization. Got a little better. It was 8 for 9 at the same level the rest of the way. Only took off a few times at AA this year. He was 2 for 4 as a base stealer. So I think there's speed in his profile. I'm just not convinced he's going to use it right away, given some of the shaky success rates we've seen.
Yeah, and I think that that's obviously critical for Marcano, because like you said, we probably shouldn't be expecting a whole lot of power given what we've seen for a lot of his minor league career. And in fact, even this year at AA for Pittsburgh, a pretty decent 183 ISO, but that's more doubles and triples than home runs, only 2 home runs at that level this year. So unless you're in a points league, I think that the appeal is pretty limited, and I think he is more of a points league guy because he's had really high walk rates everywhere. He's only got a decent walk rate so far, 7.4%, but good walk rates, pretty decent strikeout rates, doubles power. So that's a points league player right there. So more appeal there. And if the steals do come around, maybe you're looking at somebody like Cesar Hernandez, who'd be a staple in like 14, 15 team leagues. But that's a big if.
Yeah, I think it's more of a case where if he's still out there in a league where you keep a lot of players, maybe in those situations he's a good depth guy because you can kind of follow and see how things play out. But I don't know if there's as much immediate help in mixed leagues from Marcano as we would like to see. I'm curious if you have any interest in really deep leagues in Matt Carpenter. It's only been a handful of opportunities for him so far with the Yankees. Like, he started a total of 8 games. Is that right? It's not much playing time for him at this point, but do you see some deep league appeal on a per plate appearance basis, maybe similar to what Brad Miller has done at times in recent years with less playing time than he's getting right now?
Well, we talked about my AL only league on a recent podcast and used the term roster spackle, which I thought was brilliant. and that was in reference to all the Orioles and Athletics players, particularly hitters that I had on that particular roster. So I think in leagues where, a mono league where you're filling in with somebody that nobody wants because, you know, maybe they're playing a little bit more, but they're just not producing much. I think Carpenter and his more limited playing time is probably a better call in mono leagues. I think that's about as far as I would go with him, though.
Yeah, I just think at this point it would take an injury for him to play a lot more and become relevant outside of mono leagues. But I remember seeing a story. He was among the players that was working on something with having his swing calibrated. I think he was part of the Paul Goldschmidt story that I read from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, where Goldschmidt went in, and there's a company that does basically, it's like kind of like the club fitting process for baseball. And Carpenter was, along with Goldschmidt, a part of this. And it's so easy to take a player at this age. He's 36. It's just a good week. And maybe that's all it is, and just write it off. But if he actually made an adjustment and just wasn't getting a chance prior to the Yankees picking him up, it's easy for that to get completely lost in the underlying numbers. Because the numbers at AAA, he was with the Rangers organization until they finally released him, 275, 379, 613 with a 21% K rate. Again, he's an old player at AAA, but six homers in those 80 plate appearances, like that's impressive, even in the PCL.
Yeah, no, it is. I think that there's still something there. And if he were on a different team or somehow had more playing time on the Yankees, then I think I would be interested at least in 15-team leagues. But yeah, the playing time just really limits his appeal.
A watch list player for your deep mixed leagues, I think, is the way I would land on Matt Carpenter for now. Tyler Nevin getting a little more opportunity with Ramon Urias on the shelf in Baltimore. It's an oblique injury for Urias, so it might not be a very quick return for him. Do you think Tyler Nevin has any sort of mixed league future for us?
Probably not. I actually am putting him in the category of like monoleague roster spackle. I'm just not seeing a lot there other than playing time. At least he does have the playing time, and I probably would prefer Nevin. Well, you know, I just made the comment that Carpenter's preferable to somebody that you would use as that roster filler. I think it's maybe kind of a toss-up between the two of them.
One other name that I think is worth throwing out there, and actually let's make it two just because I think there's another shallow-ish league guy to think about if he's out there. Adam Duvall just keeps doing Adam Duvall things. And I think with the Ozzie Albies injury, a couple things have happened. A few hitters have moved up in the order for Atlanta, not Michael Harris, but other hitters. And Orlando Arcia is the deeper league guy that sort of emerged to pick up a little extra playing time. This seems like a situation that's going to be changed by a trade at some point. That wouldn't really impact Duvall much, but I think that would be the thing that possibly bumps Orlando Arcia back into a bench role. So I guess, is there anything different at all about Duvall, or is this just the typical guy we've seen in recent years that provides a better power and run production than people give him credit for?
Yeah, no, I think it's exactly that, and the fact that he is going well lately, and he, at least to my recollection, has been a streaky hitter, so it's going well for Duvall. You're seeing a lot of that power in the last couple of weeks. So a good hot hand play, somebody who's playing regularly, as we already talked about, in a very good lineup. So I think for those reasons, he's maybe a little bit under-rostered. I'd say borderline 12-teamer, especially if you have a categorical need for power and run production. But if he's out there in your 14, 15-teamers, I think that Duvall's an absolute must-add.
Yeah, beginning of the season, he spent a little more time hitting 5th and 6th in this lineup, mostly hitting 7th and 8th more recently. He has played a lot more than I expected. He started 59 out of 64 games for Atlanta so far this season. And he's the kind of player people get frustrated with. They drop him. He becomes available in some of those deeper mixed leagues. You could take advantage of that opportunity if that's what's happened in your league. Let's get to some pitchers. Caleb Killian is back for the Cubs, and it's been a tough year to find exciting pitchers on the wire. We've had a handful come through. Of course, the George Kirby sweepstakes a few weeks ago, Rolandi Contreras coming back up. There have been opportunities. Killian, I think, is maybe a half notch below the ceiling of guys like that, but the opportunity is what I think makes Caleb Killian really interesting, because I think if he pitches well, Al, he's in the rotation for the rest of the season for the Cubs. He returns with a two-start week as well. It's at Pittsburgh and at St. Louis if it holds up through the whole week. So what's your interest level in Killian now that he's back and given the possibility that he could actually stick for good?
I would consider Killian for the two-start week in 12-teamers. Wouldn't necessarily be my first choice. Wouldn't necessarily be somebody I would add in every situation. But if it is like a head-to-head league where an extra start would be a difference maker, I think that's a situation where I might be adding Killian. And in a way, you know, maybe the schedule would do him and us a favor if he only made the start at Pittsburgh, because I do worry a little bit about the start at St. Louis. But really my biggest concern with Killian so far, and it's, you know, extremely limited in terms of his exposure to major league hitters, but that he has had a little issue with walks so far. But I think as long as he can keep it down to, you know, around 3 walks, 3.5 walks per 9, he's going to get those ground balls. He's going to have a high enough strikeout rate that he can turn in some pretty good results, especially in a two-start week.
Yeah, I don't know if he's necessarily the kind of player that I'm going to bid aggressively for in the more shallow leagues where I'm interested, but I think he's in play for those leagues because the situation is just good enough. Weird to see the five walks that last time out against the Padres. I watched a lot of that first start against the Cardinals, his big league debut earlier this month. That was 6 Ks over five innings, three runs given up, but it was mostly done in one bad inning. I think it was the third or fourth inning. Things unraveled on him a bit, kind of recovered from it, and ended up turning in a pretty decent big league debut. So I think this profile is good enough, especially if he gets away from the fastball usage. They've had him throwing a ton of fastballs his first two big league starts. I'd like to see a little more balance in that pitch mix long term from Caleb Killian. I think this situation pitching wise has just led me to be more interested in the players currently on the IL. And sometimes you have to be even a week ahead of their actual return. An example, I think, right now is Anthony DeSclafani. It looks like he is closing in on his return to the Giants rotation. In the brief time that we saw him this season before he went on the IL, it was a pretty big step back from what he was doing a season ago, but we're talking about such a small sample of innings, 13 to 30 innings, three starts, where I don't think we want to read too much into it. How much of an impact are you expecting from Anthony DeSclafani as he gets back from this ankle injury?
Well, I think once that he is back and he's maybe not getting ramped up innings wise, you know, we'll see exactly how that plays out. But I think if there's no restriction on him in terms of that he's the streamer. He's a 12-team streamer, and potentially he has a 2-start week this week because he is eligible to return on Tuesday. That would line him up for a start in Atlanta, and then would also line him up for a home start against Cincinnati. So I don't feel great about picking him up, or I shouldn't say I don't feel great about starting him for those two starts, unless it was maybe a 15-team league or deeper, where probably he's not going to be available in the first place. But for 12-teamers, I think it is a good idea to pick him up now, get ahead of the curve, even if he doesn't make one or two starts this week. You've got him rostered, and he is somebody that you can stream reliably for 2-start weeks, for home starts, for good matchups. And that winds up being a lot of weeks in the long run.
Yeah, it really does. I'm really curious to see if the Giants want him to take one more rehab start, because he pitched Thursday for AAA Sacramento, went 2 2/3, gave up four runs, three were earned, five hits, walked three batters, only struck out a pair. It's the kind of outing where if it's just about getting to a certain pitch count and they're not worried about the results at all and they didn't see anything that was concerning in terms of velocity or movement, maybe they just let him come back anyway. But that's the most recent outing we have, and maybe they'll want him to get one more in before bringing him back. But I think even if you don't want to believe in what we saw a season ago from DeSclafani, 3.17 ERA, 109 whip, I mean, it's a really high bar to reach again for a guy that has a career ERA that's a full run nearly higher than that and has a whip in the 1.26 range. I see at least what you see, where if you have him on your roster in a 12, he's probably more in than out, where you're using him almost entirely for his home starts. There's very few matchups I can think of at Oracle Park where I wouldn't want to use Anthony DeSclafani, and then you start picking your spots carefully on the road, even in division at Arizona. Obviously, you're not going to throw him at Colorado just because of the ballpark, at the Dodgers, maybe at the Padres, depending on form and how healthy their lineup is. Maybe that can be a tough spot, but he probably ends up in your lineup 2 out of every 3 weeks, 3 out of every 4 weeks. I think that's enough to justify going after him now, even if we don't get him back coming off this latest rehab outing. Let's get to a few other pitchers. Ross Stripling, frequently mentioned on this pod. And I think part of the reason he stays so available in the shallow and medium-sized leagues is because he's in the AL East, and there are a lot of matchups that you generally don't feel great about, and that tempers expectations. But unfortunately, Hyunjin Ryu is out for the season, so this opportunity for Stripling looks like it could be a more permanent one, unless Nate Pearson's going to get healthy and push him for that spot, which doesn't seem like it's going to happen quickly, if it happens at all. So has your interest level in Ross Stripling changed as a result of Ryu's unfortunate injury?
A little bit. I did pick him up for last week's 2-start week, which went really well, and then dropped him. So this was a 12-teamer, and I wouldn't have mind keeping him, but it was a numbers game. And as you mentioned before, there's just enough 1-start weeks for Stripling where you know he's going to be riding the bench, where I just figured there'd be a better way to use that spot. So for me, in 12-teamers, I think maybe the job security that he's now got does make him somebody that's a little less risky to be stashing. But if he's available anywhere deeper, then if he wasn't a must-add before, he certainly is now.
He's doing a really good job keeping the ball in the park so far this season. Three homers allowed in 43 innings after giving up 23 homers in 101 in the third innings a season ago. I don't know if what we're seeing right now is necessarily what we want to expect going forward, but just to see some improvement from the major skills issue he had a season ago is encouraging. Control's been really good too. Just 8 walks so far in 43 innings. I actually think he's kind of similar to Desclafani in terms of my expectations. Yes. But I think the difference for me is I start thinking about the when would I use him and when would I stay away from him. There's a few more spots that come up on a regular basis for Stripling where I would end up talking myself out of using him just because of the strength of that division. Maybe the Rays are right now a team that you can comfortably throw most of your starters against, at least in deeper mixed leagues. But the Red Sox offense still scares me a bit. Obviously, the Yankees have had the best offense in the league up to this point. A few difficult parks to deal with. So maybe that's the thing that separates those two if you're looking at Desclafani and Stripling in the same situation. But if you're looking at one, you're probably looking at the other in situations where they're out there. I want to ask, what do you make of John Heasley? And I think it's a bit of a loaded question because the Royals have had such a difficult time finishing prospects at the big league level, and Heasley is much less of a prospect than a lot of the guys we've been hoping to get more from. More for a lot from Daniel Lynch, who's been a frequent discussed player on this show. Jackson Cower, stuck in the minors again, right? Not really giving us what we're looking for. Brady Singer, Chris Bubich, like the list goes on and on. Do you see anything in Heasley's profile that make you think he could actually do something good for us at the big league level? I see a pretty big disconnect between his walk rate at AAA and his walk rate so far in 7 starts this season with the Royals.
Yeah, I've been puzzled by Heasley probably as much as you or anybody else. And maybe you can look at the walk numbers from the minor leagues and be encouraged that that's going to come down. But yeah, I look for, you know, things in the profile to see, okay, well, maybe the walk rate isn't going to be great. Maybe he's not going to replicate the strikeout numbers that he's had at AAA and AA. But I look at what he's done at the major league level, and I'm just not seeing any hint because he's, you know, he's got a decent ERA, 3.72, but that's pretty much all BABIP and strand rate, and I'm not even sure what would keep the BABIP low over the long term. So if I recall, DVR, didn't he grade well in Stuff Plus? Or I seem to recall Eno writing something recently. And it definitely caught my attention because Heasley is just one of those pitchers where every time I come back and look at him, I think I'm not seeing any there.
Above average stuff, he had a 104.3 stuff number, but below average for location plus, and then subsequently below average for just his total score in the model. So close enough to average where you could talk yourself into using him in some deeper leagues, playing him in certain matchups. I think that's where I have to draw the line. I think he's a matchup-based play for me. Mostly home starts, mostly in-division starts, and know that you're playing with a little bit of fire. But I don't think 20 walks and 36 in a third innings, I don't think that's the type of walk rate we're going to get from him, considering that he had 6 walks and 26 in a third innings at AAA this year. You go back to even AA in 2021, 34 walks and 105 in a third innings. This doesn't seem like a pitcher who's had enough of a control problem where an awful walk rate is the reason why you can't use him. Maybe he's going to give up too many homers. That seems very reasonable because that's been part of his profile at multiple stops now, and maybe that's the thing that does him in, and he's very dependent on what happens on balls in play. But I actually see enough here for a 15-team league. If you're pitching desperate like I am a few places, I'm not ruling out the possibility that Heasley can actually be a little bit helpful.
Well, yeah, and I think you can look at the minor league numbers and take your chances there and hope. I'm not seeing the trend yet moving towards those numbers, but if nothing else, you could stash him in deeper leagues and see if he comes around.
lot of pitches. He's got four different pitches he throws at least 10% of the time, with the four-seamer, the changeup, the curveball, and the slider, too. And I think that's the other thing that gives him that little nudge of hope to make him a very like near min-bid sort of pickup in a few places where I just want one more starter to have to consider each week. Chris Archer still out there in a lot of leagues as well. And I thought about this morning. I was making coffee thinking about Chris Archer and how his usage is basically... it's basically the same as what I expect from Rich Hill at any given time, where more often than not, it's less than five innings. But in the right matchup, if he gets the right run support, he might pitch more. And earlier in the season, they were really careful with his workload because they let him go five a couple of times, once against the Tigers back on June 2nd, once against the Yankees on June 8th. I think they've raised the ceiling enough where you can start to choose your spots again with Chris Archer. I think he's very matchup dependent, but I think he's good enough to consider as you're kind of moving pitchers on and off your roster, trying to fill that very last spot in your lineup each week.
Yeah, and if you were inclined to think about Archer that way, then this would be a decent week to stream him. I would say not in 12-teamers, but anything deeper, because he does have a home start against the Rockies. But I will admit that Archer does scare me a little bit because I hear what you're saying about the usage pattern being similar to Rich Hill. I think the profile is not as good. More walks, more barrels, just more opportunities for Archer to explode your week. So I'd frankly be avoiding him even in 15-teamers and even with this matchup.
I'm pushing Archer in those deeper leagues. Love the matchup. Love getting the Rockies outside of Colorado, especially. I think it's going to be on that short list of five-inning starts for Chris Archer. Hopefully a bunch of Ks, too. And, of course, a win. Wins are gold right now.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Let's get to a few other streaming opportunities. Zach Davies continues to pop. Every time I'm sorting pitching stats on my waiver wire, it seems like Davies comes out as, if not the best starting pitcher available, one of the best starting pitchers available. Here he is with a two-start week at San Diego and then home against the Tigers. It's a skill set that I just don't normally trust because the strikeout rate is always very low. Is there any reason to trust Zach Davies in a two-start week with those matchups?
I think just because of the matchups against the Tigers is something you always like to see on your upcoming schedule. I would not really be looking at Davies otherwise, and he wouldn't necessarily be making the cut. And I definitely would not want to take the risk with Davies in a 12-teamer.
Yeah, I think the 12s are too shallow. It is somewhat encouraging that the K rate is up a little bit from where it was last year, 20% so far through 69 innings, 3.78 ERA and a 1.20 whip. That's what kind of gets you. You look at that and you say, this guy should be rostered, at least with volume. And I think it's fine for a two-start week, but I'm not planning on keeping him on my rosters if I do end up adding him on the cheap this weekend. Tyler Wells, another frequently discussed name on Rates and Barrels, especially because he does well in Eno's pitching model that you mentioned earlier. He's got a home start against the Nationals and a road start against the White Sox. Usage has been shaky throughout the season for Tyler Wells. What do you see right now with him?
What I see is a pitcher I really like for a two-start week. And while we're talking about him in a cohort here that's maybe more like 14-15 teamer, I'm definitely going to be considering him for 12 teamers this week because the matchups are pretty good. And obviously the biggest liability with starting Wells is that you said, you know, you might not be getting the bulk innings, and you're almost certainly not getting a lot of strikeouts in any one given start. But give him a two-start week where, okay, maybe he doesn't pick up a win, but maybe he does give you 8 or 9 innings with 7 strikeouts, and he's probably going to be giving you 8 or 9 innings with not a lot of runs and not a lot of base runners because he doesn't walk anybody and he doesn't allow a lot of base hits. This is a low BABIP, a 242 BABIP this year, a 235 career BABIP across his 2 major league seasons. This is a guy, and I've talked about this category of pitcher a lot across the episodes, what I think of as sort of like the Chris Young, Marco Estrada high fly ball pitcher that can very reliably get a lot of easy fly ball outs, which is the next best thing to strikeouts. So, yeah, I like the matchups. I like the volume, and I like the profile.
Yeah, he's gone 6 innings in 3 of his last 4 starts. So Tyler Wells kind of pushing the workload a little bit more in recent weeks. It was a lot of inconsistency earlier in the season, especially, but those Ks, they're nowhere to be found, even though I watch him and I think this guy should miss a few more bats. He shouldn't be under 6 Ks per 9. That doesn't quite add up either. So even if he's not going to be even average in that category, I don't know if Tyler Wells is going to be this far below average in the strikeout category. And I do think when you go on the road and you go 6 innings against the Jays, give up just 1 run, that's going to draw a little bit of extra attention in some deeper leagues where he's been on and off rosters pretty much all season long. Speaking of the devil, Rich Hill has another good matchup this week against the worst offense in the league. What are you doing with Rich Hill going up against the Tigers? On the roster again for a week and then off the roster next week?
Could be. That's going to be his fate in my leagues where I have him. But I am encouraged because Hill has just been getting a little better and a little better as we go on. Coming out of April, I didn't want to have anything to do with Rich Hill at all. And the last 3 starts, it's really been a pretty good stretch for him, especially in terms of the peripherals. And since the beginning of May, 3.76 Sierra, which is a bit lower than what his actual ERA has been. So when you've got a week where you've got the Tigers on your schedule, that'll play. You're talking about somebody that you can treat as like a mid to upper 3s ERA pitcher with a good matchup. That for me probably doesn't put him in the discussion for 12 teamers, but definitely anything deeper.
Yeah, he's not the only member of the Red Sox rotation getting that opportunity. One is a temporary member of the rotation, Josh Winkowski, who came up on the prospect pod last week. He should have a matchup against the Tigers. And I guess, is there anyone you wouldn't start against the Tigers right now? I mean, it's a little bit of a joke question, but Hill, I'm definitely in on for a streaming opportunity here. Winkowski, much shorter track record, but we talked about the success he was having at AAA earlier this season. Last time out, went 5, had a nice matchup against Oakland, struck out 3 batters, was 5 scoreless, scattered 4 hits, and got a win. I think that's sort of the hope that you'd have for a matchup against the Tigers.
Yeah, and I don't think it's an unreasonable expectation. So for that reason, I'm not as high on Winkowski as Hill, just for this coming week, given that probably is just a spot start. But 15 teamers, I'd stream Winkowski, absolutely.
Do you have any interest in Luke Weaver? He came back from the injured list, and I think he was used as a follower against the Phillies, went 3 innings, struck out 4, ended up getting a win. Workload concerns are definitely a factor. He's another guy that's going to line up and face the Tigers. I feel like I can't quit him from a long-term perspective, even though I know short-term, it's not necessarily 5+ on a consistent basis from him. But again, the Tigers are the worst offense in the league. So is Weaver in your group of streamers you're considering this weekend?
He is. I think we are getting closer to the line of concern. I mean, they're certainly, we go further down the list. I mean, there will be some pitchers that I wouldn't trust against the Tigers, especially with 1 start. But yeah, Weaver's not quite there. I think I'd give him benefit of the doubt in deep leagues, and because of the likely innings restrictions for the short term, he's probably still going to be available there.
All right, a couple more pitching names to think about in really deep leagues. Dean Kramer. I think he's got kind of intriguing stuff. We know the Orioles will use pitchers a little bit differently. We talked about Tyler Wells just a few minutes ago, so maybe there's a little bit of that kind of risk initially, but he's had a couple turns already. Went five last time out against the Royals. I think the possible appeal of Dean Kramer is that he could stick around on your roster longer than some of the other streaming types that we're thinking about.
I suppose I think we're still looking at deep leagues, obviously. I will say we're going to get to some other pitchers in this category that I like a lot better. But I think I'd be pretty hard-pressed to be adding Kramer outside of mono leagues.
See, I'm thinking about Kramer as the kind of guy you can get for a buck or a near min bid in a 15-team mixed league. People aren't going to be thinking that much about him. You get him now, and you're pleasantly surprised that the volume is good and that actually the stuff plays pretty well. He's got a good pitch mix. Got a four-seamer and a cutter, a changeup, curveball that I'd like to see him throw just a little bit more just because it would give him a true like four-pitch sort of arsenal. But if you go back a couple of seasons, you got to go back more than a couple of seasons. You got to go back three. The numbers at AA were really encouraging for me. 87 Ks and 84 and two-thirds innings that year, sub-3 ERA, maybe a little bit of a walk issue. And it's been up and down for him in the last couple of seasons since then. But easy to lose a guy like this in the shuffle. Obviously, there are opportunities in Baltimore for anyone who pitches well. What do you make of Braxton Garrett getting a chance right now in the Marlins rotation? We saw Edward Cabrera go back on the IL earlier this week. The matchup coming up for Garrett is a home start against the Rockies. So at least from a streaming perspective in deeper mixed leagues, I'm on board there. But do you see anything in terms of long-term value with Braxton Garrett?
I do. I mean, I'm not really looking beyond 14, 15 teamers for Garrett, but I think that there are some opportunities for him to have more good matchups, maybe not quite as good as the Rockies at Marlins Park, but I think he's somebody that if you had him in a 15 teamer, that you'd probably have him in your rotation as often as not. And he ought to have this Marlins rotation spot for the foreseeable future. So at least that's not something you're going to have to worry about.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point with Garrett. I mean, I don't see the ceiling of a lot of the other young starters they have there, but opportunity is everything, and that park alone gives him some pretty good streaming opportunities. Dylan Bundy, also in the streaming consideration group. I don't think I want him on my roster much more than that, but home against the Rockies, same start we talked about with Chris Archer. The name you put on the rundown that I like, and I was starting to scoop him up as a min-bid player even a week ago, Bo Breeski getting a chance for the Tigers and the injuries they've got. Casey Mize obviously not coming back this season at Boston, at Arizona. So he gets two starts this week. First one pretty tough, second one pretty soft. He's been pretty good with this opportunity and getting plenty of volume in the Tigers rotation.
He has, and I had him in that 24-team league that I keep referencing and dropped him there. And I don't have particularly good pitching in that league, so that tells you what I was thinking of Breeski just a few weeks ago. But it is just a cause and effect situation DVR where I dropped him and then he started really matching the performance with the peripherals, because the last three starts, 15 strikeouts against three walks in 18 innings. I don't expect him to be a strikeout per inning pitcher, but he's missing a lot of bats in the zone of 76.9% zone contact rate over those three starts to go with a decent whiff rate and a decent chase rate. So, and not only that, but it correlates with a changeup in his pitch mix. I mean, not literally a changeup, but throwing fewer four seamers, throwing more sliders and sinkers. So if nothing else, pick him up, see where this goes, because if he continues with this pitch mix and continues to miss bats in the zone and to get chases out of the zone, there's a lot to like there.
10 starts in the young career of Bo Breeski so far, 9 have gone at least 5 innings. And the one that he fell short was 4 against the Twins on the road, which, you know, it happens to good pitchers all the time. So just the guy that I don't think was really on the radar at all coming into the season, at least wasn't on my radar whatsoever, pitched really well at AA last year after a promotion from High A, missed a decent number of bats. I think we're seeing that again more recently, as you pointed out. I would be very willing to pick him up in leagues where I'm desperate for pitching, but even in some leagues where I'm less desperate for pitching, just as a good depth option based on how things are going. Yeah, the Tigers, their offense is struggling, and this is a team that's underperforming right now. They're probably not as bad as they've been so far, so I think the win potential is a little higher than you might think at first glance as well. Let's go to the closer corner. We do that to close out this show each and every week, and it seems like there's more names of interest than usual in consideration. I have one league that I've mentioned a few times in this show. It runs Fab overnight on Thursday, and Saranthony Dominguez was a big target. I think he went for 16% of a full budget. Changes may be happening in Philadelphia. They've already announced that Corey Knebel has been removed from the closer role. I don't know if we have perfect clarity on how exactly they're going to manage save situations in the short term, but it seems like most of the interest in taking a chance on that Phillies bullpen is focused on Dominguez right now. So when you look at him compared to someone like Kendall Graveman, who might be out there in a lot of leagues with Liam Hendricks on the IL, someone like Tanner Scott, who we've talked about a few times in this show, who at least has a path to maybe claim a closer role for himself, and then guys like Tanner Houck and Jose Leclerc, who could be sort of like the Rays relievers that are in and out of that role and sharing that role, how do you stack up this group? Are you more interested in finding some saves this week than in past weeks, given the actual sources that are available?
Oh, it's like finding the oasis after you've been in the desert for months. I mean, I can't even remember the last time that we had this many viable options to look at. So in terms of your question, though, comparing Dominguez to the other names that you mentioned, I mean, I wouldn't be as aggressive in bidding for him as particularly Graveman, Scott, and Houck, and really Scott and Houck, because those two Tanners could have a job rest of season. They could be in the closer's role with very little challenge for the rest of the season. Graveman obviously would be in there until Hendricks is back, although we don't know exactly when that's going to be. So to me, Scott and Houck are at the top of the list, with Graveman, you know, behind them because of the timetable. And Dominguez, I mean, I just don't know what's going on there. I had a really interesting conversation with Michael Beller on the version of this podcast that came out on Thursday, where we had Greg Jewett on, our bullpen guy at The Athletic. And he seems to think that this might just be a temporary move with Knebel out of the role. So I think between Knebel maybe coming back, or maybe coming back as part of a committee, or, you know, just even in the short run, there being a committee that doesn't give Dominguez enough opportunities, I'm not especially bullish about, you know, putting a lot of resources trying to get Dominguez on my roster. Leclerc is just somebody to, you know, think about, I think, more watch list, given that he was just activated, just coming back from Tommy John surgery. I think that Joe Barlow's got a pretty decent grip there in Texas, but just a situation to watch.
Yeah, and I think the thing that makes Graveman kind of interesting to me is that we're talking about a forearm injury for Liam Hendricks, and hopefully it is only a few weeks and he's back as expected, but sometimes those things are worse than we realize. And because of the way they manage that bullpen, I have to have a little kernel of faith that maybe Graveman could have the role to himself, whereas a lot of these other guys do seem susceptible to a committee sort of arrangement. But I think if I'm prioritizing all of them, if we're in a situation where somehow all are available, I think I'm buying into the Red Sox usage of Houck being a lot different than it was. Like, it made sense to use him as a multi-inning reliever, kind of as a middle innings bridge when a starter went short, or someone that could come in and pitch the sixth and the seventh, and all that made sense. But they've had so many issues finishing out games that maybe they're willing to move away from the committee a bit and just make him their guy in the ninth inning. Certainly has the stuff to do it. So I think it's just barely Houck over Graveman, Graveman over Scott, and then Scott over Dominguez. I think with Leclerc, I'm with you. It's a watch list situation because partially I believe a lot in Joe Barlow as well. And Leclerc's coming off some major arm injuries. So I just want to see if the stuff is even as good as it was before he got hurt. And with the Rays, I don't see a sign of them getting away from the committee. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, they're Brooks Raley, Jason Adam, whoever you believe in that bullpen, there's a whole bunch of good relievers to choose from. I still don't see a clear path to any one of them taking the job and running with it right now. If it's there, please let me know. because I think you're just throwing a dart.
Yeah, I agree. I've got Colin Poche and Aneo only, so that kind of tells you my level of confidence in pursuing any one Rays reliever in a mixed league. That's the extent of my interest.
Some things never change, or at least they feel like they never change. In the last couple of seasons, that seems to be one of those things that's been very consistent. Frustration with a group of talented Rays relievers. We are going to go. Before we go, I should mention you can get a subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month for the first 6 months at theathletic.com/fantasybaseballpodcast. With that, you can read Al's waiver wire article, which goes up each and every Friday, plus all the other great fantasy baseball content. You mentioned Greg Jewett. He writes columns for the site as well. Closer stuff that he puts together is fantastic, and it helps you deal with what is, I think, probably the most frustrating part of the entire player pool at this point in my fantasy baseball career. But if you have questions for us for a future episode, usually we go live at 4 Eastern on Fridays when there's not construction happening literally on my building. You can find Al on Twitter at AlMelchiorBB. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. That's going to do it for this episode of the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Show. We are back with you on Tuesday.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.